For the week of June 2nd, 2013, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 193, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the newsmaking headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, the world headquarters of bookfilter.com, I'm Michael Giltz.
Wow, you're really going to stick with this whole book, you know, promoting Bookfilter thing. You
launched. Hey, it's my new business.
Yeah, I mean, but we mentioned it on the last show. Now we're mentioning it again. You're becoming a PR whore.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, maybe then we should mention that you could follow us on show, you know, on Twitter and Facebook. we could promote our own stuff.
Sure.
Yeah. At Showbiz Sandbox on Twitter. And of course, Facebook is Showbiz Sandbox. But, you know, on today's show, we'll have somebody here promoting their own website and app. It works so well with Bookfilter. We're going to do it with ShowScoop. We're going to be speaking with Micah Smurthwaite. He is the founder of a website and iPhone app named ShowScoop. And this is a service geared toward letting users rate review concerts so that you know which artists are worth seeing live and why. Now, speaking of events, Michael, and events worth attending, you were at Book Expo America over the weekend. So I look forward to hearing how that went. During Inside Baseball, we'll talk about what's happening on Broadway and, of course, what's not happening, at least in regards to box office for this past season. We've got some listener email to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's our email address, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. We even have a few listeners who called and left us voicemails, and we'll play one of those. Our number is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. So we have box office for movies around the world, and it was closer than you might have expected. The number one movie around the world, again, is Fast and Furious 6. It grossed another $109 million. It's at just under $500 million worldwide. It'll pass that this week. And it's turning into a big, big success story. It's the sixth film in the franchise, and it's going to be the biggest one yet. At number two is the disastrous flop, The Hangover 3. It grossed $98 million worldwide. That doesn't sound so disastrous. It's grossed $200 million and counting. Thank God for the overseas box office. The movie collapsed in North America. Horrible reviews, horrible audience reaction. It's peaked out already. It's at number six, and it's made $88 million. It'll be lucky to trudge its way to $100 million. But overseas, the movie's doing much better. In the markets it's opened in, it's far outpacing Hangover Part 2. I don't know why. Maybe it's funnier in subtitles. Maybe the subtitles are hilarious. But for some reason, The Hangover Part 3 is doing well overseas. The last one made a ton of money overseas, and comedies don't always travel well. So they know that with the overseas box office, this movie will become a financial success. It doesn't mean there will be a Hangover 4. It does mean they won't be losing their shirts. At number three around the world is Star Trek Into Darkness. That made another $54 million. It's at $328 million worldwide. It's just about to become the most successful Star Trek film ever internationally. It's going to pass the reboot, which was the most successful ever. Before that, Star Trek didn't even play overseas. Nobody knew the show. Nobody cared about the movies, even though there were 10 or 12 of them. The reboot changed that. This movie is building on the success of that. So while it's been a bit of a head scratcher here in North America, it's doing better overseas, and it's still to open in Japan, Brazil, and a few other markets. Fast and Furious 6, by the way, still opens in China, Japan, and Australia. We don't always know what countries are left, but The Hollywood Reporter and some other outlets gave us some information. Knowing that Fast and Furious 6 still gets to open in the big, big markets of China and Japan lets you know there's still a good chunk of money on the table that's going to come to that franchise. At number four around the world is the animated family 3D film Epic that cost another $45 million. It's at $151 million worldwide and counting. At number five, the big box office disappointment, After Earth. And who is that? Is that Sony? They're already talking about how they expect and hope and pray that the overseas box office for this Will Smith film will be better and make up for what happened in North America. It grossed $29 million, and that's the opening weekend. I forgot. I was like, is that the total? Yes, that's the opening weekend. It did very poorly here in North America. It was beaten out here in this country by Now You See Me, a film, sort of a low-level film starring Jesse Eisenberg, a good solid cast about magicians who pull off bank heists in order to reward people. They're not stealing for themselves. It's sort of a Robin Hood film. And that beat out the big Will Smith sci-fi extravaganza in sort of a surprise at the box office here in North America. That movie is at number seven in worldwide because it basically opened only in this country.
And it's number two in North America. And what's interesting to me is it made $28 million. And for a film that, you know, had very little publicity behind it, I mean, it had some, but it not as much as After Earth. You know, it just goes to show you why studios like films with young casts, and they gear these films toward younger audiences because they do go see movies.
Well, I don't think this is geared towards young audiences. Now You See Me?
Yeah, I thought it was like basically a young
kid's
adult
movie.
It's not a kids movie. No. But like, you know, teenagers can see it.
It's just not a teenager movie. I think this is more of an adult film.
Really?
I mean,
okay.
Yeah. I mean, it's an FBI agent and an Interpol detective track a team of illusionists who pull off bank heists. You know, it's Mark Ruffalo, Woody Harrelson, Jesse Eisenberg, Dave Frank. I mean, these are not Morgan Freeman, Michael Caine. This isn't appealing to the teens. The kids who watch the CW are not rushing out. Now, I think if a movie's good, it can appeal to any audience, a wide audience. But I think it had a quality cast. It got far better reviews than After Earth, which had disastrous reviews. And I think this is an example of adults going to the movies. This is an example of a good mid-budget film, sort of movie studios are scared about, actually appealing to an adult audience and proving, you know, out of a nowhere box office hit. They probably didn't expect something like this. It cost $75 million to make. That's really in their discomfort zone. They like movies that cost $20 million or $200 million. $75 million scares the studios. After Earth didn't scare them. It has one of the biggest box office stars in the world, Will Smith. And it cost $130 million to make, which clearly does not include all the back end he probably has coming in for this movie. So this is an expensive, lavish, epic sci-fi film, whereas Now You See Me is a drama, a clever thriller comedy sort of drama, $75 million. It's a cast that people know, but they aren't huge draws. It's a very, very scary roll of the dice, the kind they're sort of avoiding, but it paid off for Lionsgate, who is the company behind that, and I'm happy to see it succeed. I haven't seen the film yet, but I've heard it's a pretty good movie.
And then there's After Earth, which is another film from M. Night Shyamalan, the director of The Sixth Sense.
Though you'd barely know it.
I know.
The marketing and the making of this movie, they didn't want you to know M. Night Shyamalan made it. Because before he was Alfred Hitchcock, he was John Ford, they were saying, it's an M. Night Shyamalan film. This movie, it was like a secret. It was like the reveal at the end of the movie was that M. Night Shyamalan made another bad movie, but we didn't tell you about it.
Right, exactly.
I mean, it really, I keep being surprised every time I remember that it's his film. It's the first one I think he didn't write the script, or maybe he did a polish on it or something, but I don't think he has a writing credit. So it's a work for hire, which doesn't mean he wasn't passionate about it. But, you know, it's a Will Smith film, and the fact that this once trademark name brand director made it was sort of kept on the down low.
Yeah, I'd agree.
That wasn't the case with The Great Gatsby. That tied worldwide with Now You See Me. It made another $28 million. It's at $291 million and counting. That's still well below what it needs to make in order to edge into profitability, because it costs probably about $150 to $200 million to make. But, you know, it's getting there.
Its budget is $105
million. No, it depends. I've seen $105 million. I've seen $190 million. And I don't buy $105 million. For all those big name stars and a lavish period piece directed by Baz Luhrmann. I don't buy it. So, you know, again, nobody really knows.
You're not
really
the only one not buying it. The audiences
really
aren't either.
Because, well, the audience, it's doing all right. I mean, it's, you know, it's going to be his most successful film of all time at the box office. It's just it costs more than any other movie he's ever made.
Yeah.
If you assume it costs more than Australia, which I do. You know, so we're, you know, nobody knows what the budget is. You know, we pretend we know, but these are all estimates made by outsiders or leaked by producers or people who want to make the movie seem bigger it is, so they inflate the budget, or they want to make it seem smarter and more lean than it is, so they downplay the budget, or they bury the expenses of the money the actors are going to get by making it first dollar gross rather than above the line. You know, so it's all a game. We don't really know, but it sure looks like a $150 million movie to me. Iron Man 3, of course, cost a lot of money, but nobody cares because it's making a lot of money. It grossed $18 million worldwide. It's at $1.17 billion and counting. And number 9, Oblivion, the Tom Cruise film, it's at $6 million, slowing down. It made $274 million worldwide. I think it shows he's still a big star. You know, this and Jack Reacher, he can pull a certain audience no matter what movie he makes. And yet, given the vagaries of the day and the budgets, neither one looks to be a big box office success. And number 10 is The Croods, another animated film. That's at $571 million worldwide, with just over $4 million in the till. And number 11 is a Bollywood movie. This is called Ye Jawani Hai Diwani. And it's a new movie starring, I think it translates as "This Kid is Crazy." The translation I saw is "This Youth is Crazy," but I think they mean "This Kid is Crazy." It's a Bollywood romance, of course. It had the fourth biggest opening all time in India, according to at least one website that I found, indiaboxoffice.com, which wasn't a great source. I hoped I'd found some new great source to let me see what all the releases are week to week. But Wikipedia also claimed it grossed almost $5 million to date. But that's confusing because all we have right now are figures for $2.5 million on its opening weekend. So a lot of times, you know, information from other markets is kind of sketchy and hard to come by. You're not sure who to trust, but it's certainly gotten off to a successful start. It opened in India, of course, as well as the UK, Australia, and Israel. It's the first Bollywood film in a decade to open in Israel. So we'll have to see how it does when it comes here to North America. And then right below that is Montage, the French film, which grossed another $2 million. It's at $11 million and counting. And then one more interesting film worldwide. It opened in Brazil, I believe. It's called Proeste de Caboclo.
Which
it's a Brazilian film.
I cannot
film.
Believe you just were able to do that. Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, you know, it's a Portuguese language film made in Brazil. And you remember a couple weeks ago, we talked about a Brazilian film that popped onto the charts. It was a biopic about the rock star Renato Russo.
Yeah, I
called
believe it was,
We Are So Young.
Yeah.
Or Somos Tão Jovens. This new movie is based on one of his most famous songs. It's an unlikely hit. It's a 9-minute song with basically no chorus. It's a rambling tale of a young man who heads to Brasilia for a better life because he's poor and desperate, gets caught up in the drug trade, as one will, and then he leaves it all for the love of a woman, only to get gunned down by a rival anyway.
Don't tell me how it ends. Spoiler alert.
Well, it's a famous song. It's been around since the 80s. All the Brazilians know it. He wrote it when he was 19 years old. He recorded it 8 years later with his band Urban Legion, I should say. And he died in 96 at the age of 36, which is why there was a biopic about his early years. And now we see one of his most famous songs becoming a film. I hope it makes it to North America if it's good. It sounds intriguing. I played the song online on YouTube, which you can do. I was trying to capture perhaps the proper pronunciation of the name, but it was so long and rambling, I actually didn't figure it out. So I did my best, and I apologize to anyone who speaks Portuguese who listens to our show. Some success on the indie charts here in North America. Francis Ha and Before Midnight both continue to perform strongly in limited release. Mud is finally opening overseas. That's the Matthew McConaughey film. It's hit $23 million worldwide. I really like Ethan Hawke's career lately. He has a new thriller coming out next week called The Purge, and he's doing a great job of balancing sort of genre flicks that make money and keep him a box office viable star, along with genuine indie films like Before Midnight. You know, he's just having a funky little late career period right now. The Purge is looking like it's going to track for maybe a U.S. opening of $22 million this weekend when it opens. And the other big movie opening this weekend is The Internship, a comedy with Vince Vaughn and Owen Wilson. I don't know. I saw the trailer and just sort of rolled my eyes. It's about two businessmen who become interns at Google because they're trying to, you know, restart their careers and their lives. You know, hey, will they and the other wacky, goofy interns beat out the more polished interns and, you know, win the prize? Gee, I wonder. And that looks like it might open to about $16 million. But really, all the attention is waiting for 2 weeks from now when Man of Steel opens up. Everybody expects that this movie, unlike Star Trek, will break the $100 million barrier on opening weekend.
You know, I got to tell you, I'm not a big fan of Zack Snyder, who directed this film. And I know that Christopher Nolan produced it and helped come up with the story and write it. I'm not a big fan. He makes things that look great. He made 300 and it looked great. He made, not The Weatherman.
Watchmen.
The Watchmen, thank you. And The Watchmen was just almost unwatchable. It's, you know, this stuff looks good. But story-wise, it's never there. It's never.
Well, he's not a good director. That's why you don't like him.
Oh,
but
okay.
I agree with you. So I'm hopeful that maybe this is the right director with the right project. You know, I never liked Curtis Hanson until suddenly he made L.A. Confidential. Everybody's got a great movie in them. You never know. So I don't want to rule out anybody. The trailer looks great. I know from a friend that somebody else saw it in L.A., and she's not a tough critic, but still she really liked it. So who knows? I know critics, I don't think, are seeing it until the 10th. They're holding out.
Yes.
They're not going to screen it to critics until a week before it opens. So
they screened it for a few critics here at the Warner Brothers lot on Friday.
Have they? Oh,
yeah.
Well, they're not showing it here in New York, at least to the critics I know, and they're pretty big critics, so they're not seeing it until the 10th. Did you hear what they thought?
I did not, though I get the sense, you know, I don't know what they thought. I get the sense that they would like it no matter what, although I could be wrong about
what?
That.
Your critics would like it no matter what. What kind of critics are they?
Well, I just...
MovieWhore.com? MovieQuoteWhore.com? Is that what they write for?
How do you know? How did you know that's who I was referring to?
Well, there you go. So, you know, that's the box office. The big news in North America was the fact that After Earth, the Will Smith movie, crashed and burned on opening weekend. Terrible reviews. And the big news overseas, of course, is that The Hangover 3 is doing a lot better in other countries than it did here in the U.S.
And speaking of overseas, it is thanks to overseas... Well, I don't want to say overseas. It's thanks to Fast and Furious 6 that Universal has crossed the $1 billion mark internationally. So Universal Pictures has made $1 billion overseas, just overseas, this year alone. I guess last year they were able to do that by July 17th. Obviously this year they're doing it by June 1st.
Well, a third of that comes from Fast and Furious 6, so that's certainly a big reason.
Right. They also had Les Mis and Oblivion, so they have a few hit movies on their hands.
All right. And what about hit concert reviews? You know, I've been keeping an eye on the Rolling Stones because we talked about them in our previous shows, and the reporting by some people that they were having trouble selling tickets. Frankly, every show that I see in North America in these smaller venues, these arenas, these 10 to 12 to 15,000 seaters, everyone is sold out. I don't quite understand it, because even 2 days before some shows, we were able to, you know, snag tickets online. We didn't actually buy them, but we saw that there were 8 seats available for some shows just 36 hours before they went, you know, on stage. And normally that's not a good sign. People don't usually buy concert tickets at the last minute. But officially they're reporting that they're sold out. So I don't know what's going on or how to track it. But as far as we can tell, the Stones are, you know, selling their tickets one way or another. As far as whether it's a good show or not, I don't know. We'd have to check out the reviews.
Well, Michael, it's funny that you should mention, you know, reviews and specifically concert reviews. You know, over the weekend, I was reading this blog. It's the blog of a music industry pundit, Bob Lefsetz, who had a post about signal versus noise, which contended that there was just too much information coming at us. And I would have to agree, at least when it comes to music, there's a million music blogs, and most of them are about the music themselves, not concerts. But where does one go to find out about concerts? And he was talking about, this is Bob Lefsetz, that is, he was talking about album reviews, and he said he didn't really read Rolling Stone or Pitchfork. He wrote, "At most, I'm interested in the average, like Rotten Tomatoes for movies. Give me the general feel. Is it necessary to pay attention?" And that's kind of what Showscoop.com is meant to do for concerts. It's billed as a Yelp for music, where users can rate how bands perform live, they can post pictures from each show, they can follow an act or even their friends, and kind of, like, I could follow all of your reviews, Michael. And I first came across this service at Coachella when a member of the Show Scoop team handed me a pair of promotional sunglasses, and I thought to myself, hey, we should get these guys on Showbiz Sandbox. So joining us now to tell us all about Show Scoop is the company's founder, Micah Smirthwaite. Micah, thank you for joining us.
Hey, great to be here.
Micah, from what I can tell, Show Scoop sort of launched either in beta mode or in general about March of last year. Is that about right? When did you guys get up and running?
Well, we put up a beta website last August, and then we released our iPhone app in February. So we've been up and running, yeah, I guess since August, but we've noticed when we put the iPhone app in February that you know, most of our users are actually accessing the service through the app. So February to now, I guess that's 3 months.
Okay, cool. And so the idea is that people, fans, just like they might go onto Amazon to review a book and you see like 500 reviews of a book or a DVD, there's no place like that for concert reviews. And your idea is that, hey, we've got all these acts, we've got all these fans, come online, post your review of a concert, and then other fans who other stops along the tour will give their reviews. And somebody who's saying, gee, should I see that act in concert? They can go to showscoop.com, check out the reviews and see how the act is doing. Maybe the album's great, but they're not good live. Maybe the album sucks, but they're really good live. And they can find out from other fans and people how it's looking, how it's going, and whether or not they should buy a ticket.
Totally. You said it better than I would.
You know what? He's looking for a job.
Well, here's we saw some early coverage of the website. Even last year, you were getting coverage in Wired and Forbes and other places. I know as of last August, you weren't really launched. You felt you had like 95 reviews. You were just getting on your feet and getting some attention for it. And the big question, of course, is getting enough scale with enough fans providing information, because it's fun and they get good feedback and they see other people posting it. And then suddenly it gets bigger and bigger and you've got enough of a base of reviews that suddenly becomes a really worthwhile site. So where are you today as far as like the number of overall reviews, the number of users, and you have a specialized stamp for the people who are the best reviewers or the most consistent. They're called your road crew. So where are you with all those numbers?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, a lot of these websites that have user-generated content, it's a small minority of the community that's generating a majority of the content. You know, I use Wikipedia on a daily basis, but I've never edited it. And the same goes for Yelp. Yelp found that 1% of their users were producing 25% of the content. And so
I guess those are called super users.
Yes, super users, or Yelp calls them the elite squad. And okay, what Yelp does for the elite squad is, in each city, there's if you contribute enough to the site, and it's a totally clandestine process for getting on the elite squad, but people are guessing that it has something to do with the number of reviews you've written, pictures you've uploaded, likes you've posted, just general activity on the site, quality of your reviews, etc. And if you're admitted to the elite squad, you know, monthly Yelp has these parties that are catered by local businesses who want to, you know, curry favor of these elite Yelpers, and it becomes this community. So we would like to do something similar for Show Scoop and the road crew. You know, we have some users who have one or two reviews, but then we have some users who have 100, 150 reviews. And so we want to incentivize those users to keep producing content and voicing their opinion by having some sort of incentive like the road crew. At the moment, we're not able to say, okay, 50 cities over the U.S., we can have all of these road crew communities and we'll throw a concert on some regular basis and invite all the road crew members, just because, A, we don't have all the road crew members, B, we don't have any money to do that.
But that's the plan.
But that,
down,
but that's,
down
but
the
that's
road,
the
that's how you want to get them excited. Give them a special badge, let people know that they're reviewers they can trust even more, build up their loyalty by giving them some reward, whether it's a download track or an event in their city that maybe they can come to at some point in the future.
Sure. And at the end of the day, you know, those reviews will be very powerful for up and coming bands. If you're a small to mid-tier artist that's looking for discovery or looking for exposure, you're doing everything you can to get noticed. You're uploading your tracks to a number of free tools. You're playing hole-in-the-wall clubs, sometimes for free. And so if you're able to curry the favor of one of the most prolific users and reviewers on ShowScoop, that could be just as powerful as getting a positive review on one of these major blogs like a Pitchfork or a Rolling Stone.
So, but if you're a part of the road crew, you don't have to like learn how to mic the drum kit or coil wires or anything like that, right? I mean, it's not like, you know, you're going to be lugging equipment around.
Right. You're not literally on the road crew.
Right.
If there were groupies, that would be okay. I'd learn to mic a drum kit. But anyway, so obviously being at Coachella was a big step forward in visibility for Show Scoop. How else are you trying to reach out and let people know you're around? What are sort of partnering with different websites or advertising, or what are you doing to get the word out and let people know that Show Scoop exists?
Yeah, that's a great question. Right now we're completely bootstrapped. It's just three of us. We're all just moonlighting. We haven't left our current jobs. And so
I hear you.
We're not doing any paid advertising at the moment. Everything we've done right now has been word of mouth, sharing. We hope that our users will become our evangelists. And so lots of sites have become viral through Twitter and Facebook sharing. Instagram has opened up a new API so that you can, if you post a photo on ShowScoop, you can instantly post it to your Instagram. And we can pre-upload text that says, Michael just went to the Black Keys concert and reviewed the show 4 out of 5 on ShowScoop. So we hope that those, you know, standard social sharing tools are one source of discovery for us. We also hope that small to mid-tier bands that are getting positive reviews also become our evangelists and say, hey, if you liked our show tonight, you know, rate us on ShowScoop and check us out.
Exactly. So you've got a gazillion rock concerts take place, from new bands like you're talking about who could most use the publicity of Show Scoop to big name acts that like the Rolling Stones. How do you get all the information for the concerts automated and in the website? I mean, how do fans upload the information about the shows they're going to, or are they already there preloaded, or what's going on?
Yeah, you have 2 million events in the database. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, that's a lot of events. And unfortunately, it's not 100%, you know, covering every hole in the wall concert is
impossible,
close to impossible. Yeah, some of these venues, they may not have a website, or they may not have a way to electronically upload their data. You know, and so some of those are outside of our reach. There, and so wherever there are holes in our system, there are opportunities for the community to correct those holes and upload. Okay, did we miss an event here? So you can add any artist, you can add a show to their profile that we may not be aware of.
Okay, but so where's the basic info coming from? Are you getting a feed from like Ticketmaster or some other concert touring companies? I mean, where are you getting the basic information on the major tours? Are you typing them in yourselves manually? I can't imagine that.
No way.
Yeah, exactly. It's not possible.
One of our biggest we pull data from a lot of different sources, and one of the biggest sources is Last.fm. Last.fm does a really good job maintaining all of that information for artists. So we pull for them, and then we pull from some other ticketing agencies that may be more localized or smaller to fill the holes.
Like Ticketfly or something like that.
Right. And it's incredibly, the ticket industry is incredibly fragmented. It often becomes regional. So you may be in one city and the big ticket distributor is just some unknown that has a big grasp on that city. And so we'll have to pull from there. And a lot of times those relationships between the ticket distributors and the venues and promoters, those are, you know, cemented in over a duration of years. And so,
well, I find it interesting that you say that it's fragmented, because of course a lot of people would complain that there's just this one giant monolith out there named Ticketmaster that controls everything. And
well,
that's for
big shows. He's talking about, you know, the bottom line in New York City and you know, Irving Plaza. There's a million small venues in every city.
Right. I mean, I went to see Churches, this band Churches, this Scottish band, over the weekend at the Troubadour, and it was on Ticketfly was the seller of the tickets for that particular event.
Yeah, because for small acts, there's a ton of places. For big acts, there's just basically one or two.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Ticketmaster is the 500-pound gorilla in all of this. You know, and the smaller players like Ticketfly or Eventbrite, you know, they have a fraction of the market. But when it becomes highly fragmented, is for the very local, you know, the very local, getting a pulse on what's going on in small town USA, small venue USA.
So can you give us an estimate of the fan-generated reviews that you've got on your site today or at this point?
Yeah, we're close to 5,000 right now. Certainly still a beginning, but a good start.
You got a big jump from Coachella, I imagine, if you were handing out sunglasses and were there, people learned the name for the first time.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. There was a big spike in traffic and downloads and all of that from Coachella.
Well, now, let me ask this. We were just talking about concert tickets. Do you have any plans to get into concert ticketing or I guess maybe do affiliate deals with some of these promoters?
Absolutely. You know, one of the business models for this is that we can show that our user base is influential. And so we could say, look, we have this data point about a live act, and if we show it next to an existing ticketing mechanism, then we can show this is the effect it increases on sales, and then, you know, those reviews become really valuable for the seller.
Well, now, you know, I've been going to concerts for years, Michael. I know you've been doing the same thing. In fact, one of the first concerts I ever went to, it may have been my first, you know, real concert. I think I saw Barry Manilow before this particular concert. But was Styx. I saw them in 1983 in New York City at New York City's, I think it's the New York City Civic Center or City Center. I can't remember the name of the venue. But in preparing for this conversation, I went back and looked up that date. It was April 2nd, 1983, and I found their set list from that evening on setlist.fm. And I thought that was pretty amazing. So my question is, will ShowScoop allow me to go backwards in time? And is there really any value in going backwards in time and reviewing shows that might be 3, 4, 5 years old and kind of a distant memory?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we have a history of events. I would bet that event is in our database. And for me as a concert goer and just as a fan, I like to make lists. I like to make a list of all the shows I've been to, and that's really where the whole idea started from. Is I'd go to a bunch of concerts, and I said, "Man, I wish I had a place to keep a record of all the concerts I've been to, and maybe who I went with, or my thoughts on them, or pictures, or whatever." And so, absolutely, you can, in theory, you can find any concert you've been to, and if you remember anything about it, review it. And that way you can have, you know, on your profile, a catalog that, you know, you've been to X amount of shows, and then you can see your history of where you've been, who you've seen, have you seen them multiple times, et cetera. And for me, that's interesting.
For the big acts, will you just have show by show by show, where you group them by tours eventually, where you say, okay, here's this tour, and then you'll sort of bracket all those reviews together, and then the next tour a year later, you might have a separate, because, you know, some acts can be great one tour, and maybe they're doing all their obscure B-sides on another tour, and the reviews would be poorer. So I'm just wondering if you'll break it down by tours at some point.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, if a band had a substantial amount of reviews, we could say, okay, well, you know, this is how they did this is how their overall tour score was, and here are the milestones within the tour where they performed exceptionally well, or maybe they performed poorly. And you could say, you know, well, a guitar string broke in Seattle, or the band didn't play an encore in San Francisco, but when they were in New York, you know, they went an hour longer than they were supposed to. And you really could look at a band's tour piece by piece and as a whole.
How can promoters, if you're a concert promoter, how would you use ShowScoop, or even the artist, if you're an artist or promoter, is there a way you intend for them to use ShowScoop? Because we kind of get that for a fan, it's a social network, but for somebody in the industry, there might be another way to use it.
Absolutely. When promoters and or artists are looking for discovery, you know, they have a number of advertising tools in their, you know, ad mix. So they might print out flyers, or they might give free tickets to the radio station, and you know, ways to bring awareness of their show. And we want the ability to invite a road crew member to your show and say, okay, well, you really want to get the word out in Seattle, why don't you invite a road crew member to your show the day before in Portland? They'll review your show, and then we will feature that post to all of the users who fit, you know, a certain criteria, whether it's all users that have an interest in this genre, or all users that have attended that venue, or all users that that are in this geography. We can take we can feature these reviews and drive awareness for your event.
And you're developing this, you said you're kind of bootstrapping showscoop.com. So are you developing it yourself? Are you sitting there writing the code, or do you have code writers or a development team?
Yes. Well, there's three of us that all work on it together. And, you know, we actually spent the last 2 weeks in San Francisco pitching a bunch of different investors. And, you know, we'd all like to leave our jobs, hire a bigger team, and really lever this up. You know, at the moment, we're limited in that we don't have the man hours to do all this. I want to work all day and stay up all night working on it and building out all these tools. But we need some money for that.
Right. Well, certainly it's an interesting website, and we'll definitely keep track of it. We're speaking with Micah Smirthwaite from showscoop.com. Thank you for taking the time to speak with us.
Okay. It was great talking to you guys.
Thanks a lot.
So I'd say, essentially, it's a good idea. It just needs people to find it and use it, and then it can become a success story. That's the story of a lot of websites, unfortunately. It's the story of mine. I'm sure that, you know, you need to get attention for it, but you can't afford massive advertising or anything like that. So you have to hope somehow you go viral and people find it and use it. If they do, it's certainly a perfectly good idea. Whether it should be paired maybe with Pitchfork or Ticketmaster or some bigger player that already has a fan base and therefore might give it the scale it needs in order to grow and succeed, I don't know. But I will say this, I went to the website in preparation for the story, and frankly, I saw a review for The Tallest Man on Earth, an act I love. I didn't know he was back in the U.S. He's probably the last act in the world that does not send out emails or do anything particularly active to promote himself. So even though I've signed up on his website, it's a pointless website. I didn't know he was in the country. I didn't know he was touring. And now he's not coming to my city, but he's in two cities where friends of mine are. So, you know what? I went to the website and found out somebody was touring I didn't know about, and I can tell friends to go check them out. So if nothing else, it was useful that way.
Yeah, I mean, there's another website called Songkick, and I meant to ask him, you know, what whether, you know, basically what the difference is. I would say that they're very similar, except that Songkick is meant is really more meant to warn you about concerts and maybe even sell you tickets.
Well, you know, that's what I, when I was when Time Out New York was launching, one of my big things that I wanted them to do, and it turned out that they had no interest in doing anything other than what they did in every other city because they had their formula. But one of the things I pitched to the editor when she was staffing up the site, the site, I beg your pardon, the print magazine, to be honest, there was no website at the time, or it was very minor. But anyway, one of the things I said was, I don't want a list of the concerts that are at that week in the city. I want a list of concert tickets going on sale the week that we're on the stands, because that's what people need to know about. Because, you know, 3 months in advance, most shows are sold out for the acts you love. So what you really need to know is when the tickets go on sale. And in those days when you didn't have the web like you did, that was really useful information. I say, let me know when the Tallest Man on Earth tickets are going on sale. Let me know when Bruce Springsteen's going on sale, because that's when I need to act. The day of the show is too late for a lot of acts. And so that's one of the things that I wanted. And it's certainly one of the things I still look for online as far as keeping abreast of what acts are touring and not on the road.
Yeah, I mean, and looking at Songkick now, frankly, those two sites, Songkick and ShowScoop, they might want to think about merging, because one is reviewing the acts, then that ShowScoop, that the other is promoting before the event, which is Songkick. So together,
it's a perfect site. It sounds like ShowScoop would like to do what Songkick is doing as well. They just don't have the money or time yet to add those features.
Yeah, well, and as the user base grows, that very well may be the case. And
yeah, so, you know, the user base is growing. And of course, there's so many sites to keep track of. And sometimes people say, hey, how come you always mention Spotify or Pandora? You don't mention this other great music subscription site. Tell us about one that we haven't talked about a lot and why we haven't.
Well, we have mentioned Deezer in the past. So it is a Spotify-like service. And I hate to kind of compare them, or Rhapsody or RDO or Mog. It's like those services. So it's a subscription streaming service available in Europe. That much I know. I don't know where else it's available. They have 4 million paying subscribers, actually. But it's not available here in North America at all, which is probably why we haven't mentioned it as much, because we haven't had a chance to, you know,
check it out.
Yeah, we like to. And I know, Michael, you don't subscribe to any of these services, but I do know that you go and check them all out.
That's right. And I, you know, I register and I do whatever I can to sample it. And then I just walk away because I have too much music already.
Right.
And that makes me a user of them, but not perhaps an active user.
Right. And if you were to ask Deezer and Spotify, right now, Spotify, you know, is the market leader. They have 6 million paying subscribers, so they're paying for the premium, like myself. And Deezer has, I think, 4 million. I believe I just said 4 million paying subscribers. Now, as far as active users goes, Deezer has 10 million monthly active users, and Spotify says it has 24 million. And these are active users, not people such as yourself, Michael. So there's always kind of read between the lines when you're looking at these user statistics.
Depending on how they define it, an active user is someone who's actually been on the site in the last 4 weeks or does a certain number of hours per week or month in order to qualify as what they determine an active user to be.
Right. And if you were to actually take all those numbers at face value, as Hypebot pointed out, it means that Deezer's conversion rate is, you know, from free to a paid subscription is 40%, and Spotify's is actually 25%. So it's much lower.
So Spotify has more active users that don't pay for the actual subscription service, but they can, of course, have advertising in front of them and other ways to turn them into a valuable commodity for them. But the gold standard is to turn them into paid subscribers because they love the site so much. And Deezer, one metric, is doing better on that.
Right, exactly.
All right, so that's Europe. We'd love to check it out. I'm sure they're planning to try to come to the U.S. someday, some way. And we'll keep an eye on that.
Well, and Spotify may have paved the way for them. It took Spotify 2 years to shore up all their licensing. It might be a little bit easier for Deezer, or could be even more complicated, depending on how Spotify has done. But I know one thing. I'm sure you heard a lot of statistics this past weekend at Book Expo America.
Not so much.
Really?
But no, it's more touchy-feely. Look at this great new author, this great new book. The Book Expo of America is an annual gathering. It's the biggest event of the year. There are certainly lots of events all year long, regional, national, ones devoted just to libraries, ones devoted just to certain areas of the country. So there's all sorts of events in the book industry because it's a big, big industry. But once a year, there's the Book Expo of America. This year it was in New York, as it often or usually is. It's where all the publishers and the agents and the authors and the independent bookstores and the big chains and the companies that have services to offer all gather in one place and meet face to face and have a drink and share and talk and network and meet. You know, all year long, they deal by phone or whatever. This is their chance to get together face to face and talk and look at the new fall releases and get excited about some big titles coming up that year. So it's a big, big annual event for the book industry. And of course, it's been reeling in the last few years because there was a number of years where independent bookstores were shutting down left and right. Borders, of course, the number two bookstore chain in the country is gone. It's disappeared. Everything is turning digital. Nobody knows what's going on. So, you know, the industry has been sort of reeling from all these changes. And this year at Book Expo America, you could see a lot of that happening in the way that the show was held. They weren't quite sure what to do, what their role is, who was there, who wasn't, and what they were excited about.
Well, what were some of the big topics? Like if you had to say, oh, you know, certainly it was, you know, crowded, but what were people talking about?
Well, it wasn't crowded. That's the big news to me. Like I've been to a lot of events at the Javits Center. That's the big convention center in New York City, Comic-Con. Compared to Comic-Con, this was, you know, bucolic.
Right.
You know, you were not pushing through crowds at any stage in any way, shape, or form. It was not a crowded event at all. A very slow year. I'm sure that they have statistics that would say, no. X number of booths were set up. X number of people had badges. Trust me, every single person I spoke to said it was a slow year. Business was done. People had meetings. Useful things were accomplished. But this was not a crowded year because, in part, there are fewer players around. And that's why one of the big topics was the merging of Random House and Penguin. They both had gigantic displays because they're two of the biggest publishers in North America. So Random House had this massive area with their big signs. Penguin was over there with their massive area. And you figure...
And what are they doing? They're giving out books like, hey, here's one of our books. Here's one of our books. Read our books.
Well, what happens at Book Expo is you have aisles and aisles of booths, of exhibitors. So you have everything from a small startup like Librify or Librify, which wants to be the Netflix for books, which, you know, you've certainly talked about in the past, to people offering digital services, people offering helping you ship books around the world, people offering you bookmarks, little tchotchkes like that, to, of course, the big publishers, large and small. So you have booths for independent publishers. In fact, some self-published authors, six of them, got together and had their own booth. And they walked around with name tags saying, hey, ask me how I sold 1 million copies of my books. You know, so they were sort of branding themselves just like an independent publishing company might. And then you had, of course, the major players. And so the bigger the company, the bigger their area. Just like at any expo, you know, Paramount's going to have a much bigger booth than, you know, Lionsgate or some tiny little independent film company. So, you know, the bigger the booth, the bigger the company. So you have all these booths that people can walk up and down, see the wares that are on display. And when you're at a publishing booth, of course, they have displays of the big fall upcoming titles. They have galleys to give away, physical galleys of upcoming books. They have book signings, as well as a whole area of the place set aside for book signings. And then there are meetings. You know, people come in and say, hey, is the publicist here? Is the executive in charge of digital here? And they maybe don't have a planned meeting, but they sit down at, you know, numerous tables and chat and talk and share their business. And of course, a lot of planned meetings are held as well because everybody's together in one place. Some of the big publishers have huge areas set aside just for their meetings. And there's lounges for librarians and lounges for independent bookstores. And then there's big conferences and big signings and big readings, like Neil Gaiman had a big reading. And there's just lines and lines of people lined up to get galleys, get an author signing, do all that sort of stuff. So it's like a book fair, but it's for the industry. It's for a lot of independent bookstores. It's their big outing of the year. They come to New York. They get a bunch of galleys. They meet the publishers that they only ever talk to on the phone or see a single rep. They get to, you know, brush up against big authors. You know, smaller authors try to get them to bring them there for tours. They try to get the big authors to come to their store for a tour. And they just sort of hobnob, meet old friends, and get excited about the big books of the fall and winter season.
So now, what is this thing that I see here in the notes? Power readers, inviting fans on Saturday, 500 quote-unquote power readers allowed to buy tickets. Maybe they can team up with the road crew.
That's right. Well, for the last year or two, they've been setting aside the final day and saying, hey, let's invite readers. Hey, what the heck? Let's invite fans. So they say, all right, if you're a power reader, you can buy a ticket for like, I think it was $500 and get access to Book Expo on this final day.
Basically, $500 for one day?
Or whatever the price was. I forget. A couple hundred dollars, certainly. Absolutely. Okay. So, yes. So they let fans sort of come into this trade industry thing. It's as if fans could buy tickets to Show West. Is that possible? Do they do that?
No, it's CinemaCon now, so there is
CinemaCon,
no more...
thank you very much. I apologize. Nobody wants the name CinemaCon, as we learned.
No, nobody wants the name Show West, as we learned. Yeah. I think that, no, they can't. You could if you really wanted to. You wouldn't get much out of it.
Because you couldn't get into any screenings or events?
Well, you'd have to pay, and you could get into all the events, but there'd be no real reason to. I mean, you'd see a bunch of screenings, sure, but...
Well, that would be cool. I mean, if I could buy a ticket to Cannes and I wasn't a critic and didn't have access, I'd do it in a heartbeat. So trust me, there are fans who would love to buy a ticket to CinemaCon and be able to see advanced screenings and clips and hear, you know, it's fun. If you're a fan of movies, trust me, it's a lot more fun than you think. And that's what the idea was here. Let's let fans in and meet the fans because they're the readers we need to excite. So they were allowed to come in on Saturday. That began on Wednesday with panels. Thursday and Friday was the big day for booths and meetings and all that sort of stuff and some big readings. And then Saturday was the day where fans were invited in as well. What happened was basically all the business was done. All the top executives were gone. They don't need to meet fans. You know,
it's Saturday. They have families to go back to.
Well, Most of the big people are based in New York. I mean, the independent bookstores and those people, they're in town. But a lot of the big players are already based here in New York. This is the hub of the publishing industry. So if you're at Random House or Penguin or something, you're probably here already. So it's not like they needed to fly back home. They just wanted to go to the Hamptons for the weekend.
Right.
So Saturday, fans came in, and it was kind of like a ghost town. It was sort of like, it was not that crowded on Thursday, Friday. Trust me, it was even less crowded on Saturday. And I felt like you were invited to a party after the party was over and you got to wander around and go, yeah, but it was a lot of fun.
You got to pick up all the little solo red cups.
Right. The booths were not geared towards fans, of course. They're geared towards the industry. So they still had galas to give out to fans and things like that. And there were events and Neil Gaiman did a reading. Of course, that was jam packed. You know, he's a big, big star, but it's not really an event geared towards fans. And so this sort of half-assed inviting of fans doesn't really work. I think, and I talk about it in a post I put on Huffington Post, that they really should have a book con, just like there's a comic con. There's tons of fans. There are tons of big-name authors. And the Book Expo of America is really the industry talking to itself. And I think a book con or a novel con or whatever you want to call it would be the industry talking to the rest of the country and getting attention in the broad general media. And I think there's a real need for that, but you need to have an actual event geared towards that. This is not geared towards fans, and letting them slip in and sort of look around doesn't really work.
Well, what is this thing about 99 designs that I see you have posted here?
Talked about a couple startups in my piece on Huffington Post. One is Librify. I'm not sure how to pronounce it. They want to be the Netflix for books.
Right. They haven't launched yet, I see.
They're going in beta this summer. They were very nice. They were very actually attractive. The young men and women were very good looking. So clearly they were getting the young, good looking crowd as their interns, but they were very short on specifics. I mean, I'm like, how many publishers do you have signed up? Well, I'm not really sure. Well, how many books will you have available at launch? Well, I'm not really sure. So, you know, you have to wait until they launch and see what they've actually got on hold. But unquestionably, a Netflix for books, a subscription service in which you pay a monthly fee and get access to all the books or, you know, many of the books or most of the books is something that will happen at some point. And it's probably better, I think, that publishers encourage all these startups and let all of them work and get a couple ones viable so that you've got competition like Netflix and Hulu and other sites so you don't let one company dominate everything. So, you know, I think it's in their interest if they think that the business model is good and the people are legit and have the skills, I think they should be encouraging startups like Librify. 99 Designs is another company where they've been online for a while, for about 5 years.
In fact, 99 Designs is where Showbiz Sandbox's logo was created.
Yes, you told me about them. And they've been doing this for years. They bring freelance designers in touch with people who need some designing. Maybe you've got a website, you want a logo like Showbiz Sandbox wanted. And what you do is you pay a fee, they put it out to their people, and you get a submission of a guaranteed number of designs, like say 30 or 40, depending on how much money you spend. It's like $300 to $800 at this point. And you get to choose from 30 or 40 designs submitted by these freelancers and pick the one you like best, and then that's yours. And of course, you pay a little bit more, you get access to the absolute best designers. And if you like the work of the person, you can keep working with them in the future. Now, in the past, much of their business was logos and things like that. Now they've suddenly found themselves getting more and more work to create book covers. And as that part of their business expanded, they didn't really anticipate it. They didn't know about it probably 5 years ago. But now as more and more self-publishing is happening, people need high-quality book covers. And people like 99 Designs are there to help make it easier for, you know, an independent author or just somebody who's written a book on the weekend to get a high-quality cover. They put you in touch with things. They have the contest. In a week or two, you've got a design for your book cover that looks, you know, pretty good or great. And so because of their expanding presence in the book world, they decided it was worth their time to have a booth at Book Expo America.
Well, and how did it go promoting Book Filter?
Well, I had some good meetings. Saturday was a bust. I'd forgotten that nobody was there on Saturday, but I had some good meetings. I met some people. Everybody who saw it was positive, enthusiastic. And I also want to thank the people at Showbiz Sandbox, everyone who went to the site and checked it out and signed up and, you know, giving me your feedback. I really appreciate it. That's great. I hope other people will keep checking it out and come back to the site again and again. So it was, it was useful. It was positive. I'll be better prepared next year. Hopefully I'll be on the stage doing some roundtables and acting like an expert. But it was certainly, you know, a great way to slip in and without having to buy a booth, get the word out about Book Filter. One of the fun things you can see about the whole business, of course, is this change from physical to digital books. You know, there are always going to be print books for years to come, I think, but there's no question that it's roiling the industry. And one of the big things about Book Expo in the past was grabbing a galley. That was the whole point of Book Expo. You're an independent bookstore. You want to grab the galley, the hot new fall book. You got to get a copy before they run out, because then you can read it and know in advance and get excited about it and know how many copies you want to buy and how enthusiastic you want to tell your customers you are about this book. You know, information was power. And you would think that they would just send out galleys to everybody everywhere, but they really can't. And so you'd come to Book Expo and you'd run around to try and get the books that you'd heard good buzz about and grab a copy so you could take it home and read it. It helped you do a better job in your business. So people would be walking around Book Expo with bags, lugging them, sweating and straining, carrying all these physical galleys around. That still happened this year, but because of e-galleys, because of the fact that publishers can now for free send you one right to your e-reader or tablet, there was far less demand for that. And catalogs, where they tout their new fall releases, they just sat on the tables. Who the heck wants to lug home a catalog on their airplane when they can get it online for free? So that's a big, you can see how the effect of ebooks in the industry is also affecting how they do business with their bookstores and publishers and authors and all that sort of stuff.
Yes, I think we've definitely on this show have defined that ebooks are kind of a big deal.
They certainly are. It's time for Big Deal, Big Whoop.
Oh, it is.
Isn't it? Well, it's the weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Wait a second. Why am I talking? It's your job.
Yes, you stole my line. Well, our first story this week is about Amazon Studios. They decided to let fans, decide. They made 14 pilots for web series, but rather than just deciding on their own which would click, get it? See what we did there?
I do.
Yeah, I think jokes are funnier when you point them out. In any case, Amazon Studios showed them all to viewers, all these pilots to viewers, and then they got input from fans about which ones they wanted to see. The result? They greenlit two shows, Alpha House, the John Goodman sitcom about four senators rooming together in D.C., a show created, by the way, by Gary Trudeau of Doonesbury.
Yeah, you didn't tell me that when you talked about the show. Gary Trudeau, I love him.
Yeah, it's very good. It's very funny.
All right.
And Betas, a show about Silicon Valley startups. And it doesn't really start at Begley Jr., but he's a featured actor in it. He plays a featured character. He plays the kind of like venture capitalist.
He's the big name, though, right?
Yes, he is. He's the only recognizable name. They also greenlit three kids shows. And they'll make 10 episodes each of all these shows. And according to Amazon, they won't hoard all these episodes and release them all at once instead, because staggering the release would really just keep shows from fans when they were ready and willing to actually watch them. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I love that. They sort of mocked Netflix by saying the fact that they released all the episodes all at once was cruel. You're keeping shows from fans when they're already made and ready to be seen. Why are you so mean, Netflix? So I think it's a good point, though, because I really think the publicity value of an episode a week and the attention for each episode and the premiere and the finale, you do lose that when you release them all at once. And I think promo-wise, while it makes sense to have all the episodes ready so you can gorge once the season's over, when the season has never happened yet, I think promotional value and a sense of excitement that is useful to have that week-to-week release. So I think the biggest news is not that they greenlit these shows. These were the two shows that always seemed the most likely based on the people involved, both the talent in front and behind the cameras. I don't think the fans really made a difference because they were the shows that everybody talked about from the get-go. So who knows how important it is. It may be a stunt, or maybe they'll actually...
But also, I mean, it's a timing thing. I mean, I watch both Betas and Alpha House, and the reality is, after watching it, that was an hour of my time. I don't have time to watch the other, like, 17 pilots that they've created.
Well, sure, yeah. So you're more likely to watch them first, but if you hated them, presumably you would have said so. There was one show that the fans really hated and they dissed. What was it?
I have no idea.
Oh, there was a show that the fans said, I hate this show. They were fans of the original production, and it was Zombieland. It was a TV version of Zombieland, which seemed like a lame attempt to catch up on The Walking Dead, frankly. And the fans hated it. They loved the movie, and they hated the pilot. And the writer-producer of it, Rhett Reese, was sort of bummed out. And he's like, well, thanks, guys. You hated it. You successfully hated it out of existence.
Yeah. So congratulations.
So, you know, that is a high-profile name. That's a well-known movie. I thought it was a good movie. And maybe the fans did have an effect after all. But I think the releasing of episodes one by one is probably something that Netflix will want to look at down the road for original productions.
Well, Disney is making a lot of animated films in the next few years, and the Mouse House wants to help other studios, frankly, stay out of their way. They've released the scheduled opening dates for 15 films over the next 6 years, ranging from 2 to 3 a year every single year. Three films are coming out this year alone, including Monsters University on June 21st, which I happen to see, Planes, the spinoff from Cars, on August 9th, to Frozen on November 27th. The announced dates also include an animated film with Marvel in 2014, the Finding Nemo sequel, Finding Dory, on November 25th, 2015, The Day of the Dead Project, which is not trademarked, by the way, on June 17th, 2016, and all the way to Disney Untitled Animation, which I can't wait to see, on November 21st, 2018. So, big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I'm more excited by Pixar Untitled Animation coming out in 2018, but that's just me. I think it's a big whoop. Studios have been doing this for quite a while. They like to stake their claim on a release date. Disney's doing this, you know, well into the future, probably farther into the future than anyone has ever done before. But the important thing is not this. The important thing will be when they cancel one of these release dates or they move it and they change it. Because you can't make movies on a treadmill and you cannot make these animated films. Sometimes Pixar has to strip it all down and start from scratch and start from all over again. So the important thing is not announcing these release dates, but having the confidence to say, no, we're pulling that from our schedule and not thinking people will freak out or be scared and knowing that you have to do it right rather than meet an actual release date.
So kind of the old adage, what's important in life is what you say no to, not what you actually do sometimes.
I didn't know that was an important adage, but I'll take
I think
it.
I just made it up, so you can...
It's an important Sperlingism.
Yes, exactly. Ooh, there's the title for the show. Doctor Who, by the way. I've never watched Doctor Who, so I can say without irony, Doctor Who? Doctor Who, he never dies, apparently. He just gets regenerated and played by a new actor. Since the fabulously successful reboot of the series in 2005, he's been played by Christopher Eccleston for one season, David Tennant to tremendous acclaim as the best doctor ever for three seasons in a row, and now Matt Smith to even more critical acclaim as the bestest doctor ever for the past three seasons. But the search is on now for a new doctor. Smith announced he would be stepping away from the series after a holiday special airing this November, which also includes John Hurt, as some incarnation of the doctor, and a Christmas special is also going to air. Smith was notably young at 26, the youngest man ever to play the doctor by several years, probably because, most doctors don't graduate from medical school until they're like 29, 30. But that's just...
Fair enough. Yeah. He's a Time Lord.
Oh, okay. Well, will the next doctor be a person of color? A woman? And is this a big deal or a big whoop? And here's my question. Why in the world did Matt Smith's kind of resigning from Doctor Who or announcement that he's leaving Doctor Who, why did that make the internet blow up? I mean, like, literally, he announced that he was leaving, and Twitter just exploded.
Well, because techno geeks love Doctor Who and Star Trek and Star Wars, of course.
So it's kind of a rhetorical question on my end.
Yeah, it's a 50-year tradition. It's a 50-year product. You know, this thing has been going on, TV shows, movies, books, comic books, you name it, toys. Doctor Who is, you know, of course, massive in the UK. I don't know what to compare him to in the U.S., maybe Star Trek, I guess, but massively popular in the U.K., increasingly popular here. It's not really a big deal because the Doctor always changes eventually. It's not too soon or too late for this actor. I think it's probably just about the right time, But oh my gosh, who's the next doctor going to be? I'm very excited.
Wow. Okay. Well, that makes one of us. In any case.
Don't you have children? Watch it with your kids. It's family friendly.
Okay. Well,
they're a little young, but when they're older.
Good morning, America. And I say that because Good Morning America continues to establish its new number one status in the morning TV race. GMA won the May sweeps for the first time in total viewers in 18 years. It won the key 25 to 54-year-old demo in the May sweeps for the first time in 19 years. It lost to Today in the broader 18 to 49 demo by a sliver of 40,000 viewers. GMA has been number one in total viewers all 34 weeks of this season, its longest streak in 21 years. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Big deal. We've been saying for a while, Good Morning America is number one. Good Morning America is number one. And so it's number one again. But when you can see how long it's been since it triumphed in May sweeps in all these categories, you realize what a titanic shift it's been in the morning news race. And it usually stays that way for a long, long time to come. As you know, it's 21 years since they've had this running streak of number one weeks. So my gosh, you can imagine it's probably going to go on for a long time to come. Today really has its work cut out for it. It has to become a viable number two. And that's really their job right now. They're making money, but it's a new era.
You know who else?
Every time we hit one of these landmarks, you can see how significant. I mean, 18 years, that's an eternity in television.
You know who else won the May sweeps?
Who?
Jay Leno. Glad they're firing him. That's an inside joke, sort of. In any case, this next story is near and dear to my heart. NATO, the North American Theater Owners Group, and we talked to them from time to time. In fact, the last time we talked to them was in episode 191 about movie ticket pricing. Well, they are pushing for new rules that would limit trailers shown in theaters to just 2 minutes instead of the now standard 2.5 minutes. Studios are annoyed that theater owners want to control the trailers shown in their own theater chains. Theater owners complain that the trailers are too long and give away too much of each movie's plot. That's definitely true. Right now, even, you know, there's like, what, 7 or 8 trailers are common before a movie, and that kind of, you know, the pencils out to 20 minutes. That could be cut down to, say, 14 or 16 minutes, and theater owners believe that would make movie going, get this, more pleasant. And it might even increase ticket sales. Here's my question. How about cutting back on the half hour of ads before the trailers begin? So, Michael, big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop. It's, you know, big mega chains, big companies, you know, butting heads over how to do business. I think the theater chains are right. I think trailers should be shorter. 2 minutes is plenty of time, especially when people can access longer trailers online. I think there is too much stuff before a movie. I think they do give away too much of the plot. But the idea that that's somehow going to make it pleasant and increase ticket sales is insane. That's so idiotic. Yes, people are going to go because they want to see the movie, not because of the trailer experience. If they actually cared, like you said, they'd get rid of the damn junk that's before there, and they would start movies on time. I don't care if they have trailers for an hour before the movie begins, as long as the movie begins when they say it. You know, have a 2 o'clock screening, show trailers up to 1:58, then start the movie at 2. That's what people would
There's
like.
There's some actual, there in some countries, the advertised time is the time the feature has to start. So all the trailers and the advertising has to come before that. As far as the 30 minutes before, it's actually 20 minutes of ads before, and it's called the 20 by some of the, by National
Cinema
Media.
But then they do the trailers.
But then they do the trailers on top of that. However, that 20 minutes is the walk-in time. Most people don't see all 20 minutes of those ads.
Of course not. But again, if it's a big movie and you got to get in a line and get there early and get in, which I guess is not as much the case anymore because there's so many screens. But, you know, if you get there 20 minutes before a movie, then you do got to sit through it all. It's kind of tiresome. But that's okay. As long as, you know, the trailers are there and the movie starts on time, I'd just rather know what that is. The IFC in New York does that. They say the movie starts at this point. And then there's other stuff before it, but I don't care.
Well, now, Dan Harmon, the creator of the cult NBC sitcom Community, will return to the series as showrunner for its final season. Harmon was bizarrely dumped last year. Remember when we covered that?
Yep.
It was shortly before Chevy Chase called it a day. The two had famously butted heads repeatedly. Not surprisingly, a show as distinctive and odd as Community suffered without its creative captain. NBC recognized that and brought him back. Harmon joked on Twitter he wouldn't return unless Chase did as well. That is actually kind of funny. The show has an order for 13 episodes and will air presumably sometime in early 2014. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop. It's nice that NBC admitted they were wrong. It's nice that they brought him back for the last 13 episodes, which aren't even scheduled yet. We don't even know when they're going to air. It's nice that the last few episodes will have his distinctive touch, but this is a show that's always been a cult hit at best. And, you know, they're going to have these final episodes and it'll be gone into syndication history. It's nice to end on a positive note, though. So for fans, it's a big deal. Overall, however, it's a big whoop. It's not going to change the fortunes of the show, and certainly not NBC.
Bon Jovi is making it easier for fans in Spain to cheer on the band. Fearing the economic crisis would dampen fans coming out to see the show, the band decided to drop its own performance fee and essentially do the shows in Spain for free, at least from their end. That meant ticket prices were cut in half from what they would normally have been, so more fans could see the show, with the band only making enough to cover the costs for putting on the show. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I bet you have a stronger opinion than me. I'm going to say it's a big whoop. It's a nice gesture, and of course, no nice gesture goes unpunished. I went to the link of the story that we had on this, and of course, the first comment said, "Gee, Bon Jovi, things have been pretty hard in the U.S. I'm never seeing you in concert again." It's like, well, sorry they did something nice for somebody somewhere. Let's just yell at them for it. I think, though, if you really wanted to bring joy and spirit to some place that you thought was hard hit, why wouldn't you just, like, give a free concert or something like that? I don't know. It just was a weird gesture. And why just Spain? What about Greece? What about the U.S.? What about other countries?
Well, in Bon Jovi's defense, Bon Jovi has a lot of fans in Spain. I don't know how many fans they have in Greece. They may not be as popular. And the unemployment rate in Spain is 28% and 50%.
It's horrible in a lot of Europe. Yeah.
Yeah. 50% for those under the 25 and under.
So they did say they engineered cheap tickets. Well, good for them, I guess. But I mean, give up your fee. Charge cheaper tickets. You can still make your money. You know, $20 tickets or €20 tickets are okay, Bon Jovi.
But that's what they are.
Well, no, but that's when they did this kickback thing. You know, why not just make it? You have a tour where you have lower priced tickets, not a tour where you act like you're doing charity work. But either do charity work and have a free show or raise money for something like a soup kitchen or whatever, or just have lower ticket prices because you think concert ticket prices are too darn high. But this is the weird in the middle thing. I don't get it.
You want Bon Jovi to put on a concert for a soup kitchen?
Springsteen did that all the time. They raise you raise funds for a charitable organization. You know what I mean? I'm not talking about a soup kitchen. I'm saying if you think, are you just making fun of me?
Pretty much, yeah.
All right, go on.
Okay, well, the HBO movie that premiered at Cannes, Behind the Candelabra, remember we talked about that? It was a big hit in its TV debut. Of course, here in the U.S., it debuted on TV. It was an HBO movie. It was the most watched HBO movie since the 2004 heart transplant drama Something the Lord Made. It was bigger than the Emmy-winning drama about Sarah Palin called Game Change. The numbers? The film was watched by 2.4 million viewers, with another 1.1 million watching a second airing. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Take your pick. It's a big whoop because those are pathetic numbers. It's a big deal because those are such pathetic numbers. That's right. Their biggest TV movie in a decade? 9 years? That's awful. 3.5 million people watched both things. I mean, maybe they add an HBO to go and it's bigger, but that's awful. That's far lower than a typical episode of Game of Thrones. And to have that be their highest rated TV movie in 9 years, you got Michael Douglas, Matt Damon, the world premiere at Cannes, good reviews, and only like 3 to 4 million people watched. I guess the HBO...
Well, they only have about 25 million subscribers, right? So,
right. That still seems awfully low.
That's 10%. In the first two airings, 10% of your paying subscribers watching the first two airings. Now, my understanding of HBO and the way I look at HBO is, sure, it premiered on such and such a date at such and such a time. You'll be able to see it 500 times between now and the end of the month. So you don't really have to catch it when it airs.
Right.
So
it still seemed an awfully small new number, especially when you look at the shows like Game of Thrones and what they do. They do much bigger numbers. So I'm surprised that a TV movie with big name Hollywood stars would be so much lower than just a typical episode of one of their hot TV shows. I thought they'd be a bigger draw.
Ooh, speaking of bigger draws, we should probably move on to Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And I guess this is a little bit of a Tony Awards preview, because Broadway attendance fell 6% during the last season. And I don't know, when does the season actually start?
Well, it's fall to spring.
Fall
you know,
to spring.
It goes
okay.
Like, I don't know how they count the summer months, but the Broadway season, it's an annual thing, I think, but it basically ends right about now, right about the Tony Awards.
Okay.
I don't know when they started from. I don't think they completely ignore the summer grosses. They can't. Why would they? So it must be an annual calendar. The actual season goes basically fall to May, you know, September to May, something like that. But of course, they're not going to ignore June, July, and August. So
11.5 million people went to a Broadway show this season, 10 million of whom had to turn down their hearing aids because they were whistling during the performance.
That's only in the matinees.
Okay, well, that figure is down 6% from the 12.3 million people that went the previous season, and it's really the lowest attendance since 2004.
Right, and they had a lot of explanations. They said it was Hurricane Sandy that darkened it for a number of days and dampened regional attendance because people were really hard hit in this area. And they also said the shows weren't very good. But the sad fact is that grosses were steady. So basically, they charged higher prices for fewer tickets. Hello, opera, because that's where Broadway is headed. You look at Book of Mormon, you can pay $480 for a ticket, face value, at the box office, not through some shady ticket broker, but that's what you're going to pay if you want to see the show on a Friday or Saturday night for a good seat. That's just crazy money. That's just, you know, you're pricing out the entire country, basically.
You know, I went to see the
That's what they're doing.
You know, I went to see the Scottsboro Boys.
Oh, what a great show. Was it there?
It was at, yeah, it was in Los Angeles with the Broadway cast.
And it's coming to London. So if you're in London, people, make sure you buy tickets to the Scottsboro Boys. One of the last shows by Kander and Ebb, a terrific musical. I really thought. What did you think of it?
I kind of felt the way a lot of people leaving did, which is, wow, a musical about the Holocaust. Like, it was just, it wasn't a musical about the Holocaust. It was a musical about a very a racial episode that occurred in the United States in 1931, where nine men were dragged off, and one boy, actually. So it was eight men and one boy, dragged off of a boxcar, a freight train, and charged with raping two white women. And they were, you know, the Supreme Court overturned the verdict twice, and they still wanted to keep these people in prison. It was just a very dark subject matter, and trying to sing about it, it just, and as a minstrel show, I mean, I know this isn't a Broadway review show, but it just, to me, it didn't work. The reason I mentioned all of this is I was down at the Music Center here in Los Angeles, and they are putting on, over at the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion, Einstein on the Beach. So they have three. This is the opera you love, Michael.
Yes, yes, yes. This is the production that I saw in New York. It's been touring the world for several years now. So this is, it's not a new mounting. It's the version of Einstein on the Beach that has been touring as its big anniversary event with all the original creative people involved. So by all means, anybody who can, please check it out.
Right. Well, and it's going to be performed three times here in Los Angeles, three times only, like three nights in a row. And I went into the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion's box office and asked for two tickets. And they
said, sold out years in advance, right?
No, they said, it's not, tickets don't go on sale until June 16th. And I thought, you have somebody standing at the box office asking to buy a ticket to an opera. You should be like, you should be giving me a free ticket to another opera just so that I pay for the one.
When is the production?
The
performance?
I don't know. I think sometime either. Oh, I have no idea. I'd have to double check.
Like the fall or something?
Yeah, something like that.
I thought they'd already gone on sale and were sold out.
No,
but it's a great show. And Sperling's wrong about Scottsboro Boys. If you like serious theater, it's terrifically entertaining. Was John Cullum in it?
No,
big man from Northern Exposure. So it's not the original Broadway cast.
It's Hal Linden. Hal Linden.
Right. It's not the original Broadway cast. There are some people in it who were on the original Broadway production, but it's not the original Broadway cast.
The main role was played by the same guy.
Well, that's not the original Broadway cast. That's the actor who was starred in it on Broadway. And that's one person as opposed to 15. Now, I'm not saying it's not a good production. I'm just saying it's just not, you know. So I'm sure it's a very worthy show to see, but we didn't want to mislead you. So that was on Broadway. It was not a success at all. I guarantee you, 10 or 20 years from now, that show will be revived and be a hit, just like Chicago was its second time around, because that's what happens to Kander and Ebb and Stephen Sondheim. But there were hits on Broadway this season, but most of them, unfortunately, were limited runs. Tom Hanks is a big hit, Barry Manilow was a big hit, and Bette Midler was a big hit.
Yeah, Bette Midler stars in Sue Menger's, a play about Sue Menger's, written by John Logan. And
it's called I'll Eat You Last. It's about a famous Hollywood agent.
Right. And I guess it recouped its $2.4 million investment in just over 8 weeks at the Booth Theater. And Mike Fleming over at Deadline was saying, hey, you know, Broadway shows, they always kind of tout when they become profitable. How come we don't do that with movies? Well, I think you and I both know why we don't do that with movies.
Well, say what he said.
Well, he says, what does he say here? He says, oh, I know why. When studios' tent poles cost up to $200 million with another $125 million to $150 million to launch them globally, a lot of these big ticket items probably never cover costs, and we only hear about them when the studio declares a write-down in earnings reports. Now, he did go on to say that he was the person who reported, and he was the person who reported, that Harry Potter, one of the Harry Potter films, it made $938 million and yet still showed that it was in the red.
But that's accounting. That's a joke.
Right.
So he's completely wrong. The reason Broadway touts when a show actually makes money is because they almost never do. Most shows flop. The reason Hollywood doesn't want to talk about when their movies make money is because they got all these actors and people with their hands out who want more of the dough, and they don't want to tell you how much the movie's made. They make so much money, they don't want to lie to you. They have these accounting tricks to hide the fact that they're profitable. So it's the exact opposite of Broadway. Most Broadway shows flop. Movies make a lot of money, and they don't want people to know about it. That's why they keep it a secret. So he's got it completely upside down. It's not because the movies lose money. It's because they make money. Harry Potter is not in the red. Trust me.
Well, if you read the piece, he's agreeing with you.
I know, but then he's wrong here because he says, oh, they never cover costs. And we only hear about them when they declare a write-down. Malarkey. You think these big billion-dollar multinational conglomerates are all losing money year after year and do it for the love of it? That's what happens on Broadway. It ain't what happens at the movies. The Broadway shows tout when they make money because they're so excited. Oh, my God, our show didn't lose money. And this year, we've got a couple hits that are actually possibly long-running. There's Matilda, Kinky Boots, and Motown. Those are the big three breakout hits from this year. And doing decent business, right now it's the Tony season, so a lot of shows are doing good business. But long-term, doing decent business are Pippin, Cinderella, and Annie. We'll have to see how they do after a year has come and gone. But the Tony Awards are coming this Sunday. We'll see who gets the triumph at the Tonys. And if the audience voted based on the box office, Kinky Boots will beat Matilda and Pippin will beat Cinderella for Best Revival. That's sadly what I think will happen because that's what will annoy me the most. For some reason, people on Broadway seem to find Matilda a little cold, a little intellectual. It's clearly a far superior piece of work to Kinky Boots, which is junk. But, you know, that's going to win Best Score, and it looks like it might win Best Musical. They seem to love it more. But frankly, if I was a theater owner in the regionals and I wanted to book a show and I wanted to have it that stamp of Tony approval, I'd pick Matilda.
Well, you asked about Einstein on the Beach. It will be October 11th through 13th here in Los Angeles.
Well, I'm excited that you might see it. Are you going to take your wife? It is 5 hours long, but you can walk in and out whenever you want.
I will be going.
Oh,
if I,
great.
If I can get a ticket, I'll go.
Cool. Well, I'm excited. I'll prep you for it.
Okay.
It's an experience, if nothing else.
Well, if you really want to disagree with Michael on anything, it's not all that hard, and you could probably do it by sending us an email. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our address.
It's not hard because I'm usually wrong, right?
Well, no. I mean, you can... Hey, why don't you read this email?
All right. It's a letter from one of our listeners. Her name is Vicky R. from Philadelphia. She says, hey, kids. On last week's show, you talked about Angelina Jolie's double mastectomy.
And wait. It's Angelina Jolie's double mastectomy, not vasectomy.
I said mastectomy. I didn't say vasectomy.
Okay. It sounded like vasectomy. I just wanted to, before we get a whole load of email.
Okay. I don't believe I stumbled over the words, but yes, it's her double mastectomy. And in the process, mentioned that she chose to perform such a procedure prophylactically. In her announcement, Ms. Jolie stated she tested positive for breast cancer susceptibility gene 1, more commonly referred to as, how do you say this, Sperling?
BRCA1 or...
BRCA1.
Yeah.
And you correctly pointed out how expensive such genetic testing can be, $3,340 to be more exact. I thought it worth mentioning why testing for BRCA1 and BRCA2 costs so much. A company called Myriad Genetics was the group that discovered both genes, and they have patented them. That's right, you didn't misread anything. Myriad has patented a human gene that naturally occurs, that's my addition there, and is thus the only company allowed to test for those genes. The monopoly created by patenting the gene prevents other biotech companies from creating their own version of the test. If more firms were allowed to test for BRCA1 and BRCA2, the costs would naturally decline. Myriad isn't the only group that has patented genes. Roughly 20% of the human body's 4,000 genes are patented. Granted, some are patented by groups or institutions whose sole purpose is to make sure they can be openly researched and tested for. Gene patents will soon become a big topic of conversation in the media. At the end of last year, the United States Supreme Court agreed to hear a case filed by groups such as the ACLU and the Association for Molecular Pathology over whether genes can be patented. I could go on and on about whether patenting and profiting from a creation of nature is morally or ethically correct, but I'm sure you get the picture. Maybe I should also state that I love your show and listen every week during my lab time as a biochemistry student. Thanks, Vicky R., Philadelphia. Now get back to studying, Vicky.
Yeah, we need a cure for cancer, for Pete's
sake.
Yeah,
really. What did you think about that, Sperling?
I thought I did know about the Supreme Court case, but I only knew about it because in the week leading up or after the announcement of, you know, Jolie's BRCA1 diagnosis there, it was publicized quite a bit. And there, you know, every doctor in the world is hoping that these gene patents get shot down because it is really kind of, you know, again, morally or ethically incorrect. You're basically patenting a leaf. You know, how do
well,
you
worse is it? Worse is it's bad business.
Yeah,
you know,
I mean,
well, why don't we capitalism being able to patent something in nature? And we've got this with modified corn and modified this and modified that. And we know that the patent office is totally screwed up and not in touch with the modern age, both in how quickly it deals with patents before it and trademarks, and as far as how it judges them. I mean, everything from the stupidity of Amazon being able to patent the idea of a one-click purchase button, you know, where you store your credit card and billing information so you can just click one button and therefore go right to, you know, buying an item. They patented that as if, like, that's not such a banal thing that it could be, you know, it's not possible to patent something that banal. It's like saying, press this button and call us now, and you patent that. It's just ridiculous. And in genetics, it's really outrageous, the idea that something naturally occurring can be patented. And they say, well, we found it, we discovered it, we spent the money to do so. It's like, nonetheless, it's not in the public interest to allow that patent. It's a serious biomedical and ethical issue. I'm totally with Vicky on this one, and I appreciate her pointing that out.
Yeah, I mean, we received a couple of emails pointing this out to us, and Vicky's was by far...
No, don't diss the others. We just wanted to pick one, and we thank her for doing it.
Yeah.
It's because she said she loved the show. That's why we used hers.
Well, no, because she also kind of, you know, pointed out that 20% of human bodies for that. I mean, I didn't know that. And so she was very thorough is really the word I was looking for there. Speaking of being thorough, since we're talking about medical issues and health, did you know Lou Reed underwent a life-saving liver transplant last month?
No, I had no idea, actually.
Laurie Anderson, who I did not know was married to Lou Reed.
That I knew, and she's performing in New York free shows June 18th and 19th. I hope she'll be able to do them.
Yeah, I guess Lou Reed, that's why he didn't play Coachella.
Well, was he supposed to?
Yes, he was in April.
Wow. So he was very ill. I mean, it was a life-saving, you know, surgery.
Well, you know, I mentioned earlier that if you wanted to disagree with Michael on anything, really, just anything, you know, the spelling of his name or, you know, whether it's sunny out or not, the weather, it does, you could email us dirt@showbizsandbox.com or call us 888-567-SAND. That is 888-567-7263. In fact, that's just what CJ Flynn did, and here is his voicemail.
Hi, Sperling. Hi, Michael. As you know, love the show. And, of course, after seeing... what was it? Star Trek.
Oh, wait, you know what?
The Dark. Whatever it's called. I'm trying to make that Sperling joke of Spider-Man and Star Trek, but it's not working out. Well, it doesn't work out for Sperling either. Anyway, I just want to say, as much as I appreciate what Michael has to say, usually it's gospel in our house, but I think the rant about IMAX seems off the mark after seeing Star Trek in the 3D IMAX version. I think with the dual projectors, it's superb. It's twice the light. I saw it at a local AMC here, and it was really good. And perhaps it's not perfect, but it sure is. It is above the bar. And that's all I need to say about it, except that, of course, after seeing it, my wife started saying, you know, the only thing that would make it better, and she started to describe all the things that high frame rate does. So it's kind of interesting. She's not an industry person, but she liked the 3D, and she liked she would appreciate some of the high frame rate stuff. Anyway, there you go. Have a good show.
Well, now what's he talking about, the dual projector, Sperling? That's just a standard feature of IMAX?
Well, yes. I mean, one of the things that most IMAX screens have is, or the
even FOMAX, even IMAX that is not the classic IMAX. Is that's my question?
I don't know about that. That I would have to check on. But most legitimate, you know, IMAX, you know, the big IMAX screens that are, I don't want to say, well, legitimate. Not the LIMAX or FIMAX screens, the conversions, but the big, you know, five-story tall 5-story wide screens have two projectors shooting the image on it.
Okay. And that makes for a much better, brighter picture quality.
Yes. And I should say throwing the image, but yes.
And we just should assume that he saw it in classic IMAX and true IMAX?
Is that what he's... That particular screen, the AMC in Burbank, yes, it is a classic IMAX.
Well, I don't mean to diss classic IMAX. There's precious few of them in the country. There's only one screen in all of New York City with 8 million people. And I wasn't a big fan of Star Trek Into Darkness, but I will perhaps, on his recommendation, try and buy a ticket and see it in that format, in that way, to see what the 3D is like and the actual IMAX, because 40 minutes of that film was shot in IMAX.
That's what I was going to say. I was going to say, you know, it's kind of odd that this film should be the one that C.J. Flynn was calling in about, because, you know,
it's appropriate.
Yeah, so much of that film was shot in IMAX that it makes sense.
It's not a movie that just was transferred to the IMAX format.
Correct.
So I would agree with him that if a movie is shot primarily in IMAX or a big chunk of it, and it's shown on an actual IMAX screen, I didn't mean to diss that as a movie going experience. My real problem is with movies that aren't shot in IMAX being shown in IMAX and the IMAX screens that are just glorified regular screens with good picture and sound, which every cinema should have, being sold and surcharged and upcharged as an IMAX screen when it is not the classic traditional IMAX. But I appreciate his comment that this film in particular looked great in classic IMAX, and I'll be sure to check it out.
Well, we mentioned those ways to email or call us. You can also subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Zune Marketplace, or Stitcher, or wherever they give podcasts away for free. And please do subscribe to the show, rate and review the show in any one of those podcast aggregators. It really does help us out. Of course, we mentioned at the head of the show that you can follow us on Twitter. Our username is ShowbizSandbox. We also have a Facebook page where you can like us or even submit stories for us to consider for the show. Raul Baril did so. We should have talked about that story, actually. It was about outlawing ticket-buying bots, but we just didn't have enough time. Maybe we'll cover it next week. Our Facebook page is at Showbiz Sandbox as well, so facebook.com/ShowbizSandbox. Links to all of these stories that we discussed on today's show can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll also find a link to Show Scoop, and I'd like to thank Micah Smurthwaite for joining us, the founder of showscoop.com. Again, showbizsandbox.com is where you can find all of our information, really. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, who is mgmt.com. And Michael Giltz has a website. It's michaelgiltz.com, but I have a feeling he's going to want to mention another website.
My other website is... My real name is Michael Giltz, but I may just legally change it to bookfilter.com.
.com?
Yes.
So it's .com then at the end. Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.